Good morning, members. We'll be calling the Committee for Human Services April 1st to order. First, we'll start by adopting our minutes from the March 27th meeting. Representative Gilman, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, I have.
Thank you. Seeing any changes?
They look great.
They look great. Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Minutes are adopted. And we'll note for the record, there is a quorum present. Members, today, before we start, we want to note that we have 9 bills, so we're going to be getting through a lot today. We'll move, Chair Knorr is just running a couple minutes late, so I'm going to start us off so that we can get going and get to our presentations. So first, we will start. Representative Nadeau, you have House File 2367. I will move the House file in front of us. I understand you have A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment in front of us. Oh, hi. Okay. Any discussion to the, or do you want to let us know about the A1 amendment to get into the form that you'd like?
And thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. This is just a technical amendment to the underlying settlement bill.
Okay, Representative Nadeau, you can present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I'm sorry. Just kidding.
What?
Can we adopt the A1 amendment so that it's in the form that you would like?
Okay.
I will move to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Adopted. Motion adopted. Go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. House File 2367, as amended, is a bill that reflects and funds the home care worker contract agreement between SEIU, Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa, and the state of Minnesota. Under current law, self-directed PCA, Community First, and consumer-directed workers are classified as executive branch state employees for the purposes of collective bargaining, and House File 2367 closely matches the governor's budget proposal. In addition, the new contract agreement that covers more than 38,000 workers in 4 home care programs, other providers outside of the self-directed programs, will receive similar rate increases from this bill. Cognizant of our current budget challenge, this negotiated contract makes necessary improvements in our home care workforce and their elderly and disabled clients whose needs they serve. The programs we're talking about in this bill include PCA Choice, the Community First Services and Supports Program, Budget Model, the Consumer Directed Community Supports Program, and the Consumer Support Grant. This bill invests roughly $70 million this biennium to fund the proposed contract agreement for SEIU home care workers. Of that figure, $30 million is one-time funding. In addition, there's about $55 million in the tails. We don't have yet a full fiscal note, but your packet should include the budget changes related to the contract. The contract agreement includes key provisions that help workers and their clients. On wages, the settlement includes a 40-cent per hour raise each year for a subset of experienced workers in 2 of the programs, the PCA Choice Program and the CFSS Budget Model, in both 2026 and 2027. For all workers, it uses the one-time money to provide $1,200 retention stipends. As the search for better health care insurance options for these workers continues, this stipend provides an immediate way to help cover out-of-pocket medical costs. In tight budget times, we need to target for those most in need. For clients with the most severe needs who require more than 10 hours per day of care, the contract increases the enhanced rate from 7.5% to 12.5%. To address the training bottleneck, $250,000 is added to existing training programs and to expand language access To use our workforce more efficiently, make it easier for workers and clients to find each other, the agreement includes a $1.5 million program to create an online matching service. And home care workers will now receive holiday pay when they work on Christmas. Too many PCAs leave this field because they have no way to save for retirement. While this contract does not create a retirement plan, it lays the foundation for a defined contribution retirement program. It invests $350,000 to create a joint state union body that would be the vehicle for a defined contribution retirement program. Any benefit would have to be agreed to in a future contract funded by a future legislature. As I mentioned earlier, this agreement indirectly prevents benefits programs outside the SEIU bargaining agreement as well. After DHS calculates the rate increases necessary to cover the cost in PCA choice and the CFS budget model, it provides the same rate increase to the traditional PCA and the CFS agency model. This rate increase goes directly to the provider agencies and can be used to improve wages and benefits, although there's no obligation to do that. Finally, remember, this is an open shop union. No member of the bargaining unit is required to pay dues or join SEIU, but all contract benefits are available to all members of the bargaining unit without regard to status. That's the contract, and I want to turn it now over to my co-introducer and co-author, Representative Hicks, and thank her for helping me with this.
Good morning. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you all so much. Representative Nadeau did a wonderful job explaining the value of this, but I think in this committee, what I want to highlight is we hear all the time about the shortage, workforce shortage that we see across the spectrum. We hear regularly about our 245D residential providers being strapped for staff. We hear regularly of our nursing homes who do not have enough staff. Personal care attendants and the SEIU contract allow people, like some of the parents we heard from a few weeks ago, to keep their loved ones at home. They allow them to provide the care they want to provide while also making sure that they are living in the place that they want to live. Nobody wants to put a loved one in a facility. Nobody wants to be away from their loved one if they're capable of caring for them. This contract allows people to bring supports in and provide that care.
Thank you so much. Just wanted to see if there's anyone else in the public who wanted to testify on this. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, so Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, and members of the committee, my name is Tiffany Flynn Forsland. I live in St. Paul, and I have worked in home care probably on and off for 15 years. I am testifying on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota in Iowa. We represent over 55,000 healthcare workers. Please support House File 2367. This bill will help us care for the most vulnerable. For the last 4 years, I have been PCA for my neighbor Ken. He has MS and is disabled. I have been able to help him care for himself, take him to medical appointments, and help sort through his medications. His treatment is complicated, and he does have other medical issues, so it is important to him to maintain continuity of care. The wages and other improvements mean I can continue working with him. I am excited about the bonus that will help with medical expenses. Right now, I do have insurance, but I still have lots of out-of-pocket expenses for deductibles and co-pays, and especially with vision and dental. In the past, I've gone without insurance or bought MinSure to make sure that I have insurance. PCAs struggle like me to afford health care. It's one of the main reasons. The $1,200 will be, you know, an extreme help in those expenses. This contract does not immediately put any money into retirement plan, but it sets up an infrastructure for something like a 401k. I hope in our next contract we begin to bargain, or we can bargain, over some kind of contribution. So many home care workers have no retirement, and so this would be a huge step forward. Funding for these programs has always received bipartisan support. I want to thank Representative Nadeau for being a lead author, Rep. Hicks, and the other co-authors. I know this committee strongly supports the elderly, the disabled, and those who care for them. I hope you can conclude this contract in your final budget. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Flynn Forsland, and thanks for coming. And do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify? Seeing none, members' discussion. Representative Mwanyi Hiltse.
Thank you so much, Chair, for the opportunity, and thank you, Representative Doe and Representative Hicks, for bringing this up. As a former member of SEIU, I am so proud to sit here and partake of this opportunity to support this bill. And so thank you for supporting our workers, because the work that they do is so important. And unless you've done it, unless you've had those lived experiences, they need all the support that they can get. Thank you so much.
Anyone else who wanted to speak on this bill? Seeing none, so I would. Okay, good. So I will renew the motion that House File 2367, as amended, be referred to Taxes Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes. The next bill on our agenda is House File. House File 2523. Representative Perez Vega. While you're finding a way to sit down, I will move that House File 2523 be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed with your introduction of the bill.
It's kind of difficult to hear you this morning, Mr. Chair.
Well, I've got all the energy today, so thank you.
There's a lot of echoing going on. I asked to move forward with HF 2523.
Yes, please proceed.
Thank you. I'm just going to wait till this door closes. It's kind of loud. My musician ears are trying to block it in, but yes, I'd like to move forward with HF 2523, a bill relating to human services appropriating money for HIV and AIDS support. First and foremost, buenos dias this morning, as we hope everyone had a Feliz Eid Mubarak. This is a request of funds supported services and grants administered by DHS HIV Supports Division. While nationally new cases of HIV AIDS are declining, cases in Minnesota continue to rise year after year. In Minnesota, we are averaging 300 new HIV diagnoses annually despite major advances in HIV care and prevention. This bill does not create a new division or new services supported. Since 1998, the Federal Health Resources and Service Administration allowed states to use rebates from the AIDS drugs assistance programs, which we have done in Minnesota. These rebates have funded the HIV support service grants to HIV supportive services organizations who provide critical case management, which includes ensuring people living with HIV have access to medication to suppress viral loads, have stable housing and food. The HIV AIDS Support Service Fund is now at a zero balance due to the changes around the rebate program and other changes that we are witnessing every day at the federal level. If the state does not invest in maintaining these services, it is not hyperbolic to say that many HIV and AIDS services organizations will be forced to shut their doors down in 2026. HIV AIDS can be managed, but if someone is experiencing homelessness or unhoused, they are most likely not taking consistent medication to manage the virus. It is 2025. We have this medication and science to end HIV's epidemic in Minnesota. And we must assure that those who are most vulnerable have the support they need to live in a stable and healthy life. As somebody who has seen family members 20 years ago not have access to this type of technology and science and healthcare, I do ask for folks to be sensitive to those who may be living with this that don't know what their future may look like. Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up the testimony.
The testifiers on the bill, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Good morning. My name is Kat Roan, and I serve as executive director of Outfront Minnesota, our state's largest LGBTQ+ advocacy organization. While our organization is not a direct recipient of HIV prevention funding, we know the critical impacts these funds have across the state here in Minnesota and the important role they play in ensuring that members of our LGBTQ communities and so many others across the state are supported, cared for, and protected as we all work towards a day when we can eliminate HIV here in Minnesota. 3 decades ago marked the peak of AIDS-related deaths in the United States, with the New York Times reporting on January of 1995 that AIDS is now the leading killer of Americans ages 25 to 44. Today, HIV remains a serious diagnosis, but it's one that is both treatable and preventable. That's a tremendous achievement, and one that has saved countless lives. But it took the work of organizations, public health officials, and communities working together, and that work continues today. Now more than ever, it's important that we step up as a state and fund the folks who are going to make sure that the story we tell continues to be one worth celebrating. Investments in HIV prevention and support are good investments in our state's health, well-being, and future. They will save Minnesotans' dollars, and most importantly, they will save Minnesotans' lives in years to come. I ask that you support this bill. Thank you.
My name is Hank Urban, and I'm currently a resident at Point 47 in Brooklyn Center. I have lived in Minnesota since May of 1996 and moved from Louisiana after college graduation. I moved here because of the culture of valuing others and the goal of having a better life. I have left and returned to Minnesota several times because of the quality of life is high. I've called Minnesota home for many years, and since 2011, I have accessed HIV supportive services like the Red Door Clinic, Open Arms, and Claire Housing. These organizations have made sure that I and my neighbors are safe, healthy, and housed, which benefits all Minnesota communities. Our state is a welcoming place to live. I have lived in Minneapolis, Golden Valley, Plymouth, New Hope, Robbinsdale, and now Brooklyn Center. Without continued HIV service investments, Minnesotans across the state will lose access to vital resources. Referencing the Minnesota Department of Health's 2023 Prevalence and Mortality Report, there are Minnesotans living with HIV in every legislative district. It doesn't matter how you cast your ballot, our state lawmakers have a responsibility to prevent the spread of HIV and represent Minnesotans living with HIV today. Minnesotans who are skilled and diverse will lose access to stable housing, healthy food, vital medications, and mental health support. But when all of these things come together, we thrive. We know that the $9 million in continued HIV service investments are needed to meet the needs of our communities, which the governor's $6 million allocation will not fully meet. Today, I'm advocating for $9 million, a $9 million investment in HIV services to extend the lives of Minnesotans and to make HIV a manageable disease like so many others. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you so much for your testimony. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Madeline Hammerland. I'm the HIV Housing Systems Advocate. I'm reading the testimony of the HIV Service Prevention Advocate. Thank you to members of the committee. My name is Terrell Ewing, and I have lived in Minnesota most of my adult life and spent my childhood summers on family farms in northern Minnesota. My mother grew up in both northern Minnesota and Minneapolis, meaning Minnesota has always been an integral part of my entire life. I first moved to Minnesota to be a Northwest Airlines flight attendant and live near my family. A few years later, I was diagnosed with AIDS, given 2 months to live, so I returned to my native California to be with my immediate family. I returned to Minnesota about 10 years later in 2008 to be close to my auntie, who became an important mother figure. During this time, I found myself living in a small rural town in greater Minnesota. It was only meant to be for a year or two, but I ended up calling Wadena County home for the next 15 years. I guess you could say you can take the girl off the farm, but you can never take the farm out of the girl. At the almost 90 years of age, my auntie still lives on that same farm in Verndale, Minnesota. Since 2008, I've lived in Verndale, Wadena, and at present in the Mill District of downtown Minneapolis. In rural Minnesota, we have had to provide transportation to larger urban hubs for those who need medical care necessary to live with HIV. I've acted as an executive director to an organization that provided 15 support groups in two states. creating community and reducing isolation for Minnesotans beyond living with HIV. Because Minnesota cares, we are a leader in the Midwest, and our HIV services is one of the ways we can show we care about our neighbors and our future. In the last 30 years of my being HIV positive, we've come a long way. I would like to remind those in the room that while you may not think you know someone with living with HIV, you likely do. I've heard stories of people being HIV positive due to numerous factors, including blood transfusions or IV substance use. We've learned that prevention is our most effective method to reduce cases and support those living with HIV. However, it can still progress to a life-threatening illness. HIV medications can cost upwards of $4,000 per month, along with multiple doctor's visits. Living in Greater Minnesota, I've witnessed people living with HIV who, due to many factors beyond their control, go without medication or HIV services. Viral suppression is necessary to continue to reduce new infections. Without viral suppression, the number of new cases in Minnesota will grow. Today, I advocate for $9 million in HIV service investments for rural, urban, and suburban Minnesotans living with HIV. Now more than ever, we must do what is needed to support a future where all of us thrive. Thank you for providing me time to share this testimony.
Thank you so much. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of House File 2523. My name is Lisa Lane, and I'm the External Affairs Director of Open Arms of Minnesota, an organization providing medically tailored meals and nutrition services to individuals living with HIV/AIDS and other serious illness. For nearly four decades, our organization has witnessed firsthand the critical role that proper nutrition plays in the health outcomes of individuals living with HIV/AIDS. These individuals cannot simply access traditional food shelves due to complex comorbidities or multiple illnesses that require highly customized and restricted diets and nutrition supports. For individuals living with HIV/AIDS, access to proper nutrition is not merely a convenience but a medical necessity, helping their medicines work most effectively and decreasing their risk of malnutrition. Without these specialized nutrition services, 240 of our clients will be without medically tailored meals and nutrition counseling and face significantly worse health outcomes, increased hospitalization, and diminished quality of life. House File 2523 is crucial because it will enable us to continue supporting clients who live with HIV and food insecurity. Clients like Alex, whose life took a turn two decades ago with an HIV diagnosis that left him devastated, who wrote to us to say, "What you're doing for me is a game changer. Having good food and a balanced diet helps me a lot. A month ago, my doctor said I looked the best I had ever looked. My quality of life is better now because I have the right foods to eat that make my whole body healthier." Another client, James, recently wrote urging us to keep doing what you are doing for as long as you can. "I recently became a client, and now I experience firsthand all the hard work, time, and dedication that goes into making sure we eat well. My weekly meals are precious, rare gifts that keep me going." Investing in HIV support services such as medically tailored meals helps reduce hospital visits, reduces malnourishment, and can be the difference between living independently or needing more expensive and regular hospitalization. I urge you to support House File 2523 and help us continue our mission of providing life-saving nutrition to those who need it most. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for the testimony. Any other person who wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members discussion, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair Norton, and thank you for bringing this bill. I am raising a child who is a benefit of these funds. I have a young person in my life who is beautiful, and she is kind, and she is sweet, and her mother had HIV when she was pregnant, and she did not have access to health care. And so it was these programs that gave her the antivirals necessary during her pregnancy to ensure that my child was not born with HIV. And she is now living a wonderful life, being an amazing teenager because of these programs. And they do more than just support the person. They support entire family units, and they support our futures. So thank you for bringing this bill. Thank you for the work that all of the testifiers have done and all of the things that they have done. That was 18 years ago, And this funding has been so important to so many people for so many years. Thank you.
Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Rep. Perez Vega, for this bill. I know we both work in this space, and it's just so crucial, so important. I too am seeing familiar faces here today, and I'm just so grateful for the work that you do. As Rep. Hicks mentioned, we've had this funding around for nearly a couple of decades, and it's my understanding that it hasn't really increased that much over the years. But I do know that the governor had some funding in his budget proposal. I'm wondering if House Fiscal could tell us maybe the difference between this bill and what's in the governor's budget.
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, members, the governor recommends a one-time appropriation of $6 million. And I would note that the governor's is not recurring. This makes it a biennial appropriation in the bill.
Representative Cora.
Thank you for that, Mr. Berg, and thank you, Chair, for the question. I think just important to highlight that the need is certainly greater than what Rep. Perez Vega is asking with this bill today. It's my understanding the governor's budget is lower than what we're asking for, so I hope that we can at least make that minimal mark, if not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Berg.
Yeah, thank you. This works off the discussion. What's your thoughts behind having a higher appropriation compared to the governor in amount?
Representative Price Vega.
HIV/AIDS isn't going, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. HIV/AIDS is not going anywhere. I think that a greater amount would be ideal, especially when we talk about healthcare and what we're looking at federally. That has been spoken upon the testimony. The fact that this is a illness that it continues to be an epidemic, and particularly in our communities, it's not just a metro area, but our greater Minnesota communities. When I sit down with children on the reservations and outside who have this disease that they contracted while they were born and don't have the proper resources to say that this is a consistency of being able to take care of so that we can stop this from spreading, means that it's very important that we do continue to fund it, and I would be open to have more funding than the request of $9 million.
Chair Buck.
No further follow-up.
Any other discussion? Representative Gunda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. The first is, when these funds would be allocated, are they available to everyone equally, or is it needs-based how they're allocated?
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you for the question. I would like to ask members who come from the organization to know a little bit better, but from my understanding, it is requested through a process from the grant sources for them to be able to apply. As far if I could get House Research to direct more information in regards to how fiscally that happens, that'd be ideal, or I could ask one of my testimonials to come up.
Please come to the testify table and respond to that question. Identify yourself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Phoebe, Executive Director of Clare Housing. Thank you, Chair Knorr and members of the committee, so much for being here and hearing this today, and thanks to you. The funding that's requested in this bill would go through the DHS HIV division, and they would be able to, they have previously allocated funding through RFPs, so through a competitive request for proposal process, which is quite lengthy and includes how many people you would serve on your caseloads, what the need is in your area, and then, of course, your past history of service. So if you've done successful services in the past, and we are audited through DHS quarterly with reports and then annually with a site visit plus fiscal auditing. So if you've done poorly in the past, you don't score well in the future.
Representative Gunn.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we don't really know, based upon what you've said, how the end user, then, that agency would administer the funds, whether it is needs-based or universal to all HIV patients.
To Phoebe again.
Thanks for the question. We don't. It's up to the DHS HIV division to allocate those funds. There is a set of 18 priorities within this funding pool within the Ryan White process. One, the top six, I believe, are considered medically necessary services. So that would be things like access to medication, transportation to appointments, and then things further down the list are considered non-priority services. And so the way that funds are allocated are typically to those first top priority services. So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but there's a pretty specific list of how the funding is supposed to be distributed. Ultimately, the division gets to decide how to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my last question would be, is there something we can do with the health plans? Is if there are gaps in coverage, right? If we need to allocate $9 million to supplement coverage through the health plans, is there something we're missing there? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Absolutely, President. Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. There's always something that we can do when it's talking about incorporating more funds for chronic illnesses. And I'd like to say that Minnesota should lead in the state. I've seen it happen with the Insulin Affordability Act and how many children and adults have been able to make a living and not have to pay all of their expenses to go towards a medication that doesn't cost much to make. And this goes with every chronic illness in solidarity.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Not so much to the bill itself. I think any dollars we can put into HIV prevention is a good thing for our society, and I appreciate Representative Hicks sharing the story about her daughter. My issue comes from a situation that happened here on January 21st in the public safety, where one of the organizations that is listed on the letter of support here, April 1st, 2025, back of the first page is a list of organizations, and I won't say the organizations out loud. You guys are pretty good at your Google, but one of the organizations, their member of their organization who served, I don't believe this individual is still on the organization, but did serve as an HIV outreach and prevention specialist, went into the, along with many others wearing masks, went into the public safety committee and verbally harassed the members of the committee. Now, half of the body was not here during that time. There was a work meeting going on. That work meeting was crashed. Members were terrorized. Specifically, Walter Hudson had a bullhorn in his face and was screamed at. And I think, members, that if it was on the other shoe, that if it was the Center for American Experiment or Americans for Prosperity that came into a tax committee and screamed and yelled at members' faces that did not agree with their politics, I think members here would also have issues with such an organization. So I just encourage members to, and the public too, that if you're coming to protest, that maybe you do it in a respectful manner that doesn't give members of this body kind of a sour taste in their mouth when they see them on a sheet supporting legislation. Thank you.
Representative Perez, your closing remarks.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you to all our testifiers who came in advocacy. I'm thinking about April 4th, which is coming in 3 days, which would be my cousin Roberto Tito Carreras' 45th birthday. Unfortunately, his life was taken at 20 years old by not having accessibility and education towards the resources when he was 20 years old and I was 13 years old, rushing to say my goodbyes to him. When I see folks living with their pride and living with opportunities due to accessible health care, who have this condition, who are family members, who are mothers and fathers, who are workers in Minnesota, and also just wanting to live to their highest potential, I'm grateful to be able to carry HF 25 and 23 to fight for the accessibility of their health care and everyone's health care with love, justice, and peace. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, House File 2523 is laid over. The next bill we have is House File 1742. Representative Perez Vega, welcome again. I will move that House File 1742 be laid over for possible inclusion in omnibus bill or budget bill. Please proceed with the introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I am moving forward HF 1742. This is relating to human services with establishing direct support for professional certification of a pilot program requiring a report. I'm going to ask my testifiers to come up a little early while I open this up here so we can get rolling. Let's get back to this. Minnesota has been grappling with the direct care worker shortage, which we heard in the previous bill before me, due to a direct care worker shortage crisis for many years. The Olmstead subcabinet report approved in March of 2018, entitled Recommendations to Expand, Diversify, and Improve Minnesota's Direct Care and Support Workforce, provided key recommendations on how to best address the direct care crisis. Yet, the direct care workforce shortage gap has continued to deepen. House File 1742 builds upon lessons learned, specifically the Direct Care Recommendations Report. Provide tiered credential options and career ladders for direct care and support for professionals. Metropolitan Center for Independent Living has been working for many years on just that, bringing curriculum for the direct care workforce that leads to credential of the certified direct support professional. HF 1742 calls for the Commissioner of Department of Human Services to establish a three-year direct support professional certification pilot program in partnership with the Commissioner of the Office of Higher Education, Anoka County, Dakota County, the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living, and willingly post-secondary institutions to implement a direct support curriculum leading to the credentials of certified direct support professional. The project calls for stipends to support all who become students entering this program, whether job seekers, direct care workers, family members, or people who rely upon direct services, or even college students to complete the educational program leading to this new credential of certified direct support professional. This project seeks to place certified direct support professionals across Minnesota's direct care services for children and adults with disabilities and older adults who rely upon direct care services for daily living. HF 1742 calls for the creation of accreditation criteria that provides guidance to other post-secondary institutions who wish to develop and implement a direct support professional certificate program. The Metropolitan Center for Independent Living, which is in District 65B, in cooperation with Commissioner of Human Services and local pilot counties, shall facilitate coordination among the post-secondary institutions located within the pilot counties. Allow me to introduce my testifier here, Jesse Beth B. Gomez, the Executive Director of Metropolitan Center for Independent Living, to testify as project leader for this pilot. Thank you for being here, Jesse.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Nor, Chair Schumacher, Representative Perez Vega, thank you, and to committee members for allowing us to be here in support of House File 1742. I'm here, first of all, by those who have asked me to be here. It was in August of 2019, Rick Cardenas, who worked with the executive branch and the legislative branch to have accessible ramps to the state capitol. And it was actually Rick and Tim Benjamin, who was the editor for Access Press, who years ago said, Jesse, please get involved with the direct care workforce shortage crisis. This is why we had become involved. I was one of the technical writers on the 2018 Olmstead Recommendations Report, and Metropolitan Center for Independent Living has been working assiduously to address the crisis. Metropolitan Center for Independent Living worked with DEED, worked with Human Services, worked with everyone to put together the curriculum that we now have. And this project really brings forth post-secondary education to bring forth this educational opportunity as a next volunteer level. The medical model has a certified nursing assistant, which plays an incredibly important role in the medical system. Our healthcare system also has home care and direct care, and the certified direct support professional really helps to make certain that we have a counterbalance to make certain that we're bringing those skills, bringing those capabilities forward to attract new workers. When we wrote the recommendation report in 2017 and 2018, our direct care workforce gap was approximately 10,000 people. Today, it's estimated that direct care workforce shortage gap is 53,000 people. That means people are displaced, they're long-term care settings, they're going into places that a skilled nursing home is $153,000 a year. and people want to get back into their homes. So this is a way for us to pilot this, to look at how do we invest, how do we go to scale, and we're excited about the possibilities of really working over time to solve the crisis, a crisis that so many have hoped and so many look forward to being able to live daily with the support of direct care workers. We're very excited about this opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members' discussion. With that, I think we have closing remarks from Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you. The, you know, HF 1742 provides opportunities for workforce, and particularly when I think about our higher ed and those who are joining the workforce for the first time with opportunity to have accessibility to a $20 per hour stipend for 80 hours of instruction. This is jobs, and we want to get more of our workforce gearing up, especially to help those in most need who are capable of being able to provide for Minnesota as well.
Thank you so much. With that, House File 1742 is laid over.
Thank you.
The next bill we have is House File 2319, Representative Badja. While you're coming to the testify table, I'll move that House File 2319 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill or budget bill. With that, please proceed with the introduction of your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. So House File 2319 funds the minimum wage standard proposed by the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board according to the requirements of the law governing those rules. The minimum wage that was passed in the fall of 2024 updates the minimum wage floors for nursing home workers across the industry. So that new minimum would be $19 an hour in 2026. And $20.50 an hour in 2027 for all nursing home workers, with higher minimums for certified nursing assistants, trained medication aides, and licensed practical nurses. With the funding in this bill, the rule would go into effect January 1st, 2026. In order to go into full effect, the rule would need this appropriation from the legislature as well as approval from the federal government. To determine the cost of the rule to the state's budget, DHS has developed a fiscal note that in your packets will show that the cost is $6,000 this biennium and $5.6 million in the tails. Also in your packet is the change pages for this proposal from the governor's revised budget, and that figure does show a higher number of $14.7 million in the tails, but they have a higher number particularly because they are accounting for interactions with the governor's proposal of a 2% cap on the growth in the VBR reimbursement rate. But if we didn't have that proposal or if the legislature decides to do something different with that proposal, the cost would be lower. Over the couple of years I've presented on the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board, there does seem to be an agreement that we want better pay and wages for nursing home workers as a retention tool in this industry. And in order to achieve that, we do need money to the nursing homes. But despite the investments we've made through the VBR system, there doesn't seem to be enough for the workers, even though the rates for the VBR system have increased by 100% in the first 10 years of the program. So that was why the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board was created, to ensure that more of the money that we invest in nursing homes would go to the workers who are taking care of the residents. The goal of the Standards Board is to raise the standards for those who work in our nursing homes and care for our loved ones. And while this would be a change across the industry that does require legislative approval, the purpose is to ensure that regardless of where one works, they can expect the same standards and not have to search around for a better wage in order to care for those in most need. It helps both the workers and the residents when staff is less concerned about making their own ends meet. And with this funding, the industry can meet that standard and support both workers and residents over time. So I ask your support for nursing home workers and to consider this bill as part of your budget package. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much for the introduction of the bill. We have testifiers on this bill. Please welcome to the testifier table. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Sam Kanegi. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I work at South Shore Care Center in Worthington as a dietary aide. I am a member of AFSCME Local 105. I am here to testify in support of House File 2319, which would fund the minimum wage rule from the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. I've been working as a dietary aide for about a year. I work in the same facility as my mom, Vicky, an LPN who is here today. We work in a nursing home because we care about our residents and our community. I want to help people. I like the residents I serve, and I work hard to make them feel at safe and at home. However, this job has really taken a toll on me mentally. It's been really difficult for me, but I really do love the residents, so I stay. We are always burning through staff constantly because we are overworked and underpaid. We are constantly having to train new people in, which is difficult for both the nursing home staff and the residents. We really don't get paid enough for the hard work we put in. I currently make $15.25 an hour, which isn't really enough to make a living, to even get a house, to pay for groceries. I've sometimes wanted to quit because of the mental toll, and I really don't get paid enough. I've even thought of going somewhere else or I'd get paid more, but I can't leave these residents. I love them too much. I'm glad the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board exists, and workers like me can have a role in shaping the standards for an industry. We need the minimum wage increases set by the board. I urge you, strongly urge you, to support House File 2319. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Travis Berth. I live in South St. Paul. I am a server and a cook at Serenity Care Center. I am here on behalf of my union, SCIU, Minnesota, and Iowa. We support House File 2319 because our industry and your money will work better when all workers have a voice on the job. I started working at Serenity in December of 2020 in the middle of COVID. Boot camp with the U.S. Army was not that bad compared to working in a nursing home that does not have enough staff. When I worked weekends, we would often just have two servers for two whole buildings. Together, we feed 160 people. I watched one of my best mentors quit because she couldn't take the short staffing anymore. She lost hope. Things have gotten a little better since COVID. Money from the legislature has helped. Thank you. But we also got more say over our jobs through the standards board because the board we got time and a half for the first time on President's Day. It made a big difference. Nursing home workers know that the minimum wage will be going up. That gives them hope. Things will continue to improve. I think the prospect of a statewide minimum wage has already led to better wage increase where I work. But just because you fund nursing homes does not mean the money winds up in our pocket. In fact, last year, my coworkers joined the largest ever one-day strike of Minnesota nursing home workers. I almost went on strike last week. The problem is not just the lack of funding. The business press says a lot of people make money off of nursing homes. Last year, my facility, we won a grievance to recover $4,000 of unpaid wages. The hardest part of my job is feeling powerless. The board provides a way for all workers, including those without a union, to speak up and feel like they have power to make things better in their nursing homes. Raising the minimum wage will help grow our workforce, but giving people hope may be just as important. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. To the next testifiers, please come to the testifier table, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert, and I'm here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I will start with what I believe is a goal that we do share with Representative Agbaje. We want nursing home workers to earn family-sustaining wages, and that has been our number one priority for years. Respectfully, however, House File 2319 is not the right tool to achieve that goal, and we only need to look at the fiscal note of the bill to understand why. If you look at the fiscal note on page 2, under implementation timing, it does acknowledge that since this bill does not include an upfront appropriation, the state doesn't incur any cost until January 1st of 2028. So as this committee knows, that is a it reinforces the point that that only is true that the state incurs costs on January 1st, 2028, if all nursing homes are able to front load this full expense on their own and carry it for 21 months. Number two, if you look under the rate impact, also on page two of the fiscal note, it acknowledges that the rate increase will be, quote, different per facility, and then appears to use a sample size of three nursing homes to estimate a per resident day impact. There are 315 nursing homes roughly in the state of Minnesota with 315 different rates. Again, that different per facility in the analysis. So to assume that a sample of three nursing homes is reflective of the entire state is extremely unlikely. And then third, as noted on page three of the fiscal note under system costs, it simply identifies $5,000 in 2026 and $1,000 per year thereafter, but doesn't articulate what systems are impacted by the change and how. And this was never raised by the Nursing Home Workforce Standards board members themselves. So the bill and the fiscal note make it pretty clear the standards don't work without an upfront appropriation. And I'll turn it over to my colleague to complete our testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kyle Berndt. I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative in opposition to House File 2319. To continue for my colleague, we believe the bill and fiscal note underscores three important considerations for the legislature. First, line 1.7 of the bill itself is designed to circumvent the requirements of statute and rules that make the wage standards effective contingent upon a legislative appropriation. Given the payment delay that Aaron had talked about and lack of upfront appropriation, the rule passed by the board violates the legislative budget rules. The very underlying workforce standards law is structurally broken without subsequent fixes by the legislature every time a rule or standard looks to be adopted that impacts the Medicaid budget. Second, House File 2319 raises a valid question before the legislature. If the analysis of the board is instructed to estimate, the estimation itself is fundamentally broken, and future legislatures are going to be needed to approve standards anyway, why have a board at all? Third, while we disagree with the financial analysis by the board, we do believe the fiscal note makes one point very clear. A cut to nursing homes is a cut to nursing home workers. Let me explain. The governor's budget recommendations include $15 million in the outgoing biennium for the standard, as compared to the $6 million fiscal note that you see in this bill here. If you look at that financial estimate, that $9 million difference is because the governor had to buy back his cuts to Medicaid. If the goal is to improve wages for workers, it should be through opposition of the governor's budget in support of House File 1419, which is authored by Chair Schumacher. We additionally would also strongly encourage the legislature to enact critical board reforms to the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board to prevent having the same conversation every single year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify? Seeing none, members' discussion. Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think all the comments that were made today about this bill are accurate and appropriate. There were a couple of things that flagged for me. When the bill was introduced, it was stated that this was to comply with the law, and the first line in here is notwithstanding the law, this will go into effect. I was wondering, Mr. Chair, first with this, what's the bill amending here? Is it amending a rule or statute? I legitimately don't understand that piece.
We can get clarification from the nonpartisan staff. Ms. Pignelli.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 2319 just contains an uncodified section that, were it to be enacted, would be in Minnesota laws and not placed in statute. The actual text of the bill is notwithstanding a section in current statutes and any other laws or rules to the contrary of what this bill is trying to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds to me like we're really trying to circumvent the laws and the rules that were there, not really moving according to the laws there. I did have a question on the fiscal note as well, if Mr. Berg could help me understand. Mr. Berg, if budget rules require the forecast to be built on current law and the minimum wage rule is not effective until next January, is the cost of that rule actually reflected in the forecast or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, you're correct that the forecast is a point in time that looks at current law projected forward and with adjustments like utilization, but current law on it. So the changes to the wages that are part of this recommendation that would be in the law are not in the underlying forecast, but they are then in the fiscal note, the cost of the bill, which is also in the governor's recommendations.
Thank you. So the changes here are not in the forecast, but will be expected to carry them forward. It's interesting, too, I think, that the point that was made about how this is less expensive than what the governor's budget was, because the governor has to buy back some of the cuts there, is noteworthy. And the costs that we have here don't actually go to wages. It goes to systems in the first couple of years with that. I'm curious, too, in this fiscal note about the three facilities that were chosen for this. Would someone be able to help understand that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think I have Director Bailey. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair members, or Chair Nor members, Elise Bailey, Budget Director of the Department of Human Services. That in the three facilities in the fiscal note is actually a typo. The fiscal note is based on all facilities.
Chair Schumacher.
Okay. Thank you. So how does that work then?
Director Bailey.
Chair Nor, Representative Schumacher, basically what we do with the fiscal note here is we look at what we're assuming under current law with the VBR rates going into the future and what wages will be paid over that time under current law, and then compare that to what the standards are doing. So if the standards are increasing wages at a level that is higher than what we would assume the VBR rates to go up under current law, the cost of the fiscal note is that difference. To answer your previous question on why the governor's budget is different, it's basically the same proposal except for elsewhere in the governor's budget, we also are capping the VBR rates at 2%. So it is, there's an interactive effect, and that is why this cost is different.
Chair Schumann.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. And it's an interesting point, and I appreciate that, Director Bailey, on the points that you make, that it does start to show if the funding doesn't keep up with that. It's interesting to me to see that the point was made that the dollars that are going in aren't going to direct workforce, but as we put a, at the same time, there's the argument that with a minimum wage, it's only going to have a cost to the state of $5.5 million in the out years of things. And so what gap is it really closing there is a question I would have going forward with this. I think overall, though, to just wrap this up, I think that this bill really just reinforces the notion that legislation should be approving laws and rules, and that's really the point in this bill hearing and the bringing the bill up itself. I think it begs the question on the purpose of the board and what they'll be doing and how we should be approaching this in the future. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Do we have anyone else? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, my concern really is what happens to our nursing homes. Can you give us an idea of what the impact will be financially for nursing homes with this in terms of their labor costs?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair. I can also get some more details if I need, but ideally the cost to the nursing homes, I mean, this would be part of the VBR calculation that we already do, which is already which already takes into consideration costs from about 2 years ago, so the rates are already at the 2021 and 2022 levels, and so that's how they interact with each other. If your question is sort of getting at the idea of nursing homes that may not be able to afford this cost, the board and the department are working and will release kind of how to do a waiver process for those institutions. But otherwise, this would be part of the rates that they apply for already.
Mr. Chair, you know, it might work out for a waiver program. I don't know how you pick. In my rural area, they all struggle with just staying afloat. So I had 14 different nursing homes come in as a group, and they said my average cost for when you raise the bottom in an area where I'm not competing, the bottom, as far as the rates of employment are not there, and you raise me up, everybody goes up in the nursing home. So the cost for those nursing homes was $234,000 a year. That was their average cost. My largest one told me that their annual cost for this minimum wage law is $217,000. And so these are real costs. We already cap them on the one end. We make it really difficult for them to come up with the money. And I know their margins are extremely tight, but this is really hard on our rural nursery homes especially. And we don't have to be in the same pay rate to compete typically as you do in the metro area, but we're treated the same. And so it's really difficult. So it makes it really, really hard on our rural nursing homes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. So Director Bailey, for the critical access nursing facilities, do we have an investment for Greater Minnesota if the nursing homes are unable to, you know, compete with many of the urban areas?
Chair Nora, representatives, yes, we have a separate program called the Critical Access Nursing Facility Program where nursing homes can apply and then they receive a temporary rate increase in addition to their VBR rates. And then, you know, once that's done, they can reapply again. I forget the base, maybe $2 or $3 million a year off the top of my head, but I can get the, unless you know, Mr. Berg. Okay.
I believe I can it get was you the base 10 million. Amount. It was $10 million, and we increased it last
okay, you know.
Fiscal year. Yeah, we increased a couple of million dollars last year. So, yeah, there is some Critical Access Nursing Facilities Fund to support Greater Minnesota nursing homes who are struggling so that they can stay open and afloat. That is something which we invested in. We also added to the base additional funds last fiscal year. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up then. Can you give me an idea, like how many nursing homes applied, maybe what their a typical amount would be that would help them to come up with that program?
Director Bailey.
Chair and representative, I can get you that number. I don't have it off the top of my head, but we can certainly get it to you today probably.
And I also have a bill that increases the critical access nursing facilities.
So just one more follow-up. Just for the group here today, can you just give us a ballpark? How many people applied for that? What kind of dollars? Or is it difficult to come up with that?
Director Bailey.
Chair and Representative Murphy, the appropriation is a flat appropriation. And so it's the total amount paid would be the base appropriation. I can get you the total number who applied. I that varies each year, but we can certainly get you that today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Any other question, Representative Franson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, last month, well, this article was written on March 19th, yeah, so last month was March. I can't believe it was March already. Birthday month is over. So I did a town hall type deal with Senator Westrom and Representative Paul Anderson, and we held it at Vivi in Alexandria, which was formerly known as Canute Nelson, and we had homes from around
the area speak with us about the issues that the workforce, the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board was going to bring and the concerns. And I asked specifically to have the meeting so that we could have the press there and highlight the concerns that the homes are having and bring it out more in a public sphere. It seems like the public is all focused on possible cuts in Washington, D.C. that may affect the state, but not too many people are paying attention to the governor's budget that literally cuts disability services, literally cuts nursing homes. And what I found from this town hall meeting was kind of concerning. So the Pioneer Home in Fergus is looking at a $2.3 million in reduction. The home in Belgrade believes they will not survive the projected cuts the first year. Minnewaska is looking at a $780,000 cut over 4 years. They have, and if you add in the other locations they have, which is six other locations, that's $5.2 million over 4 years. And then there's the mandated education that appears that only unions are providing the training. I don't have very many union nursing homes in my neck of the woods, but those are the people that do the training. The other concern is, so we're talking about nursing homes bumping up the CNAs, et cetera, but there's no discussion on housekeeping and culinary, those staff that aren't listed specifically in the bill, that the homes would also have to give a bump up in pay. You can't bump up everybody else and then leave housekeeping and culinary at the same pay wage. So it is very concerning. I've got a list here of an example of five homes. They're not all the homes in my district, but Bethany on the Lake over 4 years is looking at over a $2 million cut. Kira of Sauk Center is over $1.4 million in cuts. Community Memorial Home, almost $1 million. Canute Nelson, which is Vivi, this is just for their ALEC location, is $1.1 million. And Kira of Melrose is $2.3 million over 4 years. Members, it's extremely concerning. We worked so very hard. Many of you were not here during that time, but Republicans were in control, and that's how we got the VBRO pay that we had worked so hard. And for so many years, members, it was Democrats that were running on nursing homes and saving nursing homes and funding nursing homes. And when I got elected in 2010, that was probably the number one issue, that in disability services, raising those wages of the PCAs during that time. And now I feel that we're going backwards, Mr. Chair, and Co-Chair Schumacher, I feel like we're going backwards in this and trying to fight for every penny to remain with nursing homes. Quite honestly, Representative, they cannot absorb these cuts. And a potential waiver, you know, when you go to the critical access nursing facility funding on how that CANF program works, it says they may receive a rate increase, external fixed add-on, for up to 2 years. Up to 2 years. What happens then after that 2 years if they still can't survive on their own? It's a very concerning, and I quite honestly don't know how we solve this issue, Chair Schumacher and Chair Noor, when it comes to the budget. And I think we need to be realistic and put away partisanship and do what's right for our seniors here in Minnesota. And that may be getting rid of the Workforce Nursing Home Board standards. And I understand there's a lot of passion. People worked really hard on this issue, but sometimes it's okay to come back to the legislature and say, you know what, my idea, my pie in the sky idea, just is not going to be able to work out realistically. And it's okay to admit that we were wrong and move forward to something that will work. Thank you.
Director Billy, do you have any comments?
Chair Noor, members, I would just say there is a waiver process for the standards. that a nursing home can apply for to waive, you know, if they can show that they can't make ends meet, to if implementing this standard would result in, you know, financial burden where they can't make ends meet, they can apply for a waiver, and then there's a process to which they wouldn't have to meet the standard. The nursing home, the critical access nursing home, is another venue, so that is separate from these standards. So that, in addition to that, will help rural nursing homes in their financial, you know, difficulties in providing care to folks in rural Minnesota.
With that, I think we also invested $300 million last fiscal year. We also have the loan program of almost $100 million. We invested 4 years. Almost $900 million in the nursing home, an increase of 7.8% annual rate. And also we increased the critical access nursing facilities fund. We will continue to invest in our seniors as part of our promise to the seniors. So we have a lot of work. And I think we're discussing many things that are in the governor's proposal. We have to have our own proposal in how we are going to approach the targets that we got. I know we're all frustrated with that target, but it's up to us to figure out how to best support and reduce the cuts that we may see that will impact individuals with disability, our seniors, the most vulnerable individuals in our state. So, Representative Franson, just the closing, before we go to the closing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $300 million that was passed from 2 years ago, that is what you're referencing, correct? The increase of $300 million?
It wasn't an increase. It was only one-time funding.
Correct.
That we were planning to support because of the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic to make sure that nursing homes have good resources to stay afloat.
Right. So that thank you, Mr. Chair, sorry. That $300 million, members, that Republicans had to fight for actually came out of our bonding projects of the cash. That was my understanding is that Republican members took kind of a hit on our bonding projects because we needed the money to put toward nursing homes, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for the reminder. I think the bonding was equally divided along the caucuses. As far as I understand, there was any hit on any group. So with that, Representative Agbaji, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members, for your time. I appreciate the robust discussion that we've had. Again, I believe that we all agree that taking care of our nursing home workers, taking care of our nursing homes, and ensuring that our residents get the best care they can is important. A lot of that does depend on pay and wages, and the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board has been in effect for about 2 years now, and they've been able to do that with the holiday pay resources. And they are very cognizant, and they do talk about the issues facing nursing homes and the ability for them to succeed and survive in this environment, which is why there are a number of off-ramps for nursing homes that really cannot afford this. But for those that can, and for those that can take advantage of the resources available to help them stay afloat, I believe that this is a way forward to continue to support not only our workers, but also our residents in those homes. So thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, House File 2319 is laid over. The next bill we have is House File 671, Representative Hicks. I'll move on behalf of Representative Hicks, moves House File 671 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you so much, committee and chairs. This bill is really designed to address, frankly, our children boarding problem. Many of you in this room have heard me talk about my concerns about children's mental health and where we're putting our kids and how we're serving our kids when they're in a mental health crisis. I also serve on Children and Families, where I have listened to stories that would make anyone sob. We have an amendment, Chair.
Yes, I can see you have A1 amendment. Did you want to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, please.
Representative Hicks moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair. This bill, with the amendment, does a few things. It takes a look at our MnChoice assessments, which we know is one of the biggest barriers our hospitals are facing. In certain parts of the state, families are waiting 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, even to receive a MnChoice assessment, regardless of the fact that the statute states 30 days. Our county partners are the only ones who are doing these assessments, which leads to delayed time in completion and also, frankly, burnout from our partners. I know of cases in our communities where children have literally sat boarding in hospitals for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months because they can't get them in choices. This bill clarifies and strengthens those county timelines and accountabilities. And to be fair, there are some concerns around some of the sticks in this bill. And we're working on some of those and trying to find a solution. But the truth of the matter is children boarding is a problem for everyone. Everyone agrees it's not working. And I suspect the solutions we find will make everyone angry. No one is going to be happy with the compromises that we come to because no one is happy with the situation. It does create a MnChoices team at DHS to go and be deployed in the hospitals in these situations. And counties will have to reimburse DHS to do those assessments if they cannot make it happen. It expands the pool of MnChoice assessors, making it easier to do the assessment. And it gives hospitals the ability to have their own MnChoice assessors, but they can only use them if after the DHS team does not complete the assessment. We don't want to make MnChoices a hospital function, but if the only barrier to leaving a hospital is a MnChoice assessment, we must find solutions to get it done. And as I said before, I recognize that some of these things may feel harsh. And I do, we are in conversation, and I think we will find some compromise. But the truth of the matter is, this is harsh for the hospitals, too. This is harsh for families who can't bring their children home. This is harsh for providers who have beds and are willing to provide services but can't accept children because the MnChoice isn't done. We must find a solution, and chances are everyone's going to have some skin in that game because we all do right now. We need to better understand why the backlogs are happening and understand the numbers that we're working with. There are other bills that look at limiting time in reassessment. There are other bills that look at extending different portions and what we can do in this space, including identifying what we do need to do. So, members, enough is enough. We have had children sitting in hospitals for over 365 days. No child should be being raised in a hospital because we cannot get this done. This bill does some other things as well. It works to clarify peer specialists. It talks about juvenile reentry benefit for consideration. It removes the crisis stabilization bridge funding, and it really does help us deal with complex kiddos, including linking to school-linked mental health, wraparound services, peer supports, lots of things that are necessary. We can continue to put our heads in the sand and do nothing. Doing nothing is a choice, and we can continue to make that choice as a legislature. That is a choice we can make. We can choose to do nothing. However, the more nothing we do, the worse the situation gets, the more children are living in hospitals, and frankly, the more children we end up spending a lot more resources on because they didn't get the care they needed when they needed it. With that, Chair, I would like to allow my testifiers to speak.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Noor, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here to talk about this important issue. My name is Jennifer Gustafson. I'm the clinical supervisor at the Dakota County Juvenile Services Center. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association. Our juvenile detention facilities have become a safety net in the mental health continuum of care. Over the past 5 years, there's been a significant increase in the number of children boarding in our detention facilities. In 2024, a survey showed that on June 1st, 20% of all youth in Minnesota correctional facilities were there because of their mental illness. Most of these children stay for extended periods of time waiting for the care that they need. As the clinical supervisor, I can share that we are woefully under-resourced to meet the needs of the children who are boarding in detention. Our youth caring professionals do their very best to provide trauma-informed responses, create accommodating and therapeutic spaces, and truthfully, the children in our care just require far more than we are designed to give them. We have children as young as 10 years old boarding in detention. Boarding in detention is challenging for all children with significant mental health needs. The structure of a detention facility, from just the physical space to daily routine, can be challenging, as these facilities were originally designed to meet the needs of safety. Despite strong efforts to create trauma-informed responses in a correctional setting, there are limits to what can be done to support the individual needs of these children. For some children, boarding in detention can be very stressful. Examples are a 12-year-old child living with autism who's been discharged from a residential or group home setting now finds themselves in a correctional facility with youth who are often much older and dealing with other challenges. This can be confusing and overwhelming for a child, where their mental health symptoms are often misunderstood and they do not receive the intensive support that they need to make progress. Or a 17-year-old child living with schizophrenia who's experienced extensive trauma and is now boarding in a correctional facility in Minnesota for over 300 days. She was discharged from a group home due to her aggressive misbehavior, which is a symptom of her mental health. She loves animals and nature, and she aspires for a career in that area. But despite her goals for herself and recommendations for services, she waits in detention as placement is not available for her. Our juvenile detention facilities are working to support the mental health needs of children while they wait for care. We know there are solutions that can help children transition from boarding to the community and treatment settings, and one is high-fidelity wraparound. High-fidelity wraparound supports transitioning children from boarding to community care and preventing youth from entering boarding by ensuring the right services are in place and active. It is a youth and family voice and choice-centered service designed to support families and establish long-term solutions to meet their needs. One provider shared, 24 months after completing WRAP, 92% of youth remained in the community, not requiring a higher level of care. House File 671 will build capacity for this specialized service to grow the model across the state. Children should not be boarding in Minnesota. We know detention is not an appropriate treatment setting or a safety net for our kids. We support the solutions to children boarding in House File 671 and know that together we can do better for our children. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members. I'm Dr. Margo Zarin-Pass. I'm a physician and at Children's Minnesota, excuse me. I appreciate you all having me here today to share my experience as a doctor caring for some of the stories that Representative Hicks referenced, caring for children who are stuck in the hospital boarding because they cannot access appropriate mental health care services. So my goal in being here today is to tell you more, share more information, about the patients and the families who I and my colleagues take care of in the hospital. So in many cases, the children I'm taking care of in the hospital are brought there by their family who aren't getting the support they need to take care of their child. The emergency department is their last resort, and we don't turn kids away. And commonly, the child in question is having outbursts or aggressive episodes, like my colleague mentioned, And they may have experienced extensive childhood trauma or abuse. They may have neurodevelopmental differences like autism, or for whatever reason, the kids lack the coping skills they need to deal with the stress they're under, and their families are often at a complete breaking point. And no matter the situation, hospitalization is not what these kids need. I want to be very, very clear that these are not hopeless cases. These kids are beautiful, they're smart, they're curious, they have enormous potential, and with the support that they deserve, that potential could be realized. If I had a magic wand, I would give these children and their families access to intensive family therapy, skill building, respite care, resources like youth care transition teams to help remove barriers for getting these kids out of the hospital to the right treatment center and make sure they're getting ongoing support. I'd make sure that their care is not delayed by MinChoice assessments, as Representative Hicks discussed. And moving resources, you know, I'd try and move resources more efficiently through the system based on the specific child in front of me. My colleagues and I are on the front lines of the mental health crisis. We see this ultimate failure of the system to take care of these children. The bill before you and other bills will finally move the needle on this issue and ensure that children and families can access care they deserve. So thank you, Representative Hicks, for your leadership, and thank you, committee members, for your time.
Thank you so much. The next speaker, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Noor and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 671 this morning. My name is Todd Archbold. I'm a social worker and the CEO of Prairie Care, one of the state's largest organizations providing mental health care for children, adolescents, and adults. As highlighted in the recent report by a Center for Advanced Studies in Children and Welfare at the University of Minnesota, children with mental health needs are often left in hospital emergency departments, not for treatment, but simply to be kept safe. This is not just a failure of our system, it is a failure of our humanity. These children, who are vibrant members of our community, are being deprived of the treatment they desperately need. They're not just statistics, they're individuals with dreams and aspirations. They're artists, athletes, friends, and our children. They deserve better. The report emphasizes that many of these children are stuck in a cycle of boarding due to a lack of available and appropriate care options. As one parent poignantly noted, when my husband had cancer, the whole family had cancer. It wasn't just him. This sentiment rings true for our children. When one child suffers, the entire family bears the burden. We must recognize that mental health care is not just about the individual, it is about the family system as a whole. This bill seeks to expand access to community-based services, which is crucial. The report indicates that intensive community-based services can prevent the need for higher-level placements. Investing in these services is not just a moral imperative, it's a practical solution that can save money in the long run. When we provide the right support early on, we can prevent the escalation of crisis that lead to emergency room boarding. Moreover, the report underscores the importance of collaboration among providers. The Mental Health Collaboration Hub was established to bring together clinical leaders throughout the community to identify care pathways for children who are boarding. This effort, driven by the goodwill and commitment to kids, has shown us that when we work together, we can create a more effective and compassionate system. As one expert stated, it's simply bringing people together to the table and listening to each other. We need to foster this spirit of collaboration to ensure every child receives the care they need when they need it. As one recent example, a bright teenage girl went to the emergency room in crisis, not her first time. She had faced unimaginable challenges, living with autism, depression, and PTSD, a result of the horrors of sex trafficking. She had been in and out of treatment centers, and her misbehavior, which is really a symptom of her illness, the voice of her despair, resulted in setbacks. Hospital staff shared her case with the Mental Health Collaboration Hub, which opened the door to a network of dedicated professionals committed to finding the right treatment for her. After 172 days of boarding, she was finally offered a chance for a fresh start at a local treatment center where she could receive specialized care she needs. This bill leverages the expertise of the Collaboration Hub to implement a boarding decompression pilot to fund individualized solutions for children to transition to community-based care from boarding and track those outcomes to apply lessons learned in ongoing solutions. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for this important legislation and to this committee for your support. I believe that together we can create a brighter future for Minnesota's children. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We have another testifier via Zoom. Jill Paula, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and Chair Noor and members of the committee for having me. My name is Jill Pooler, and I am the Aging and Disability Services Manager with Wright County Health and Human Services, and I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Social Services Administrators, known as NACSA, as well as MICA, the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Thank you for having me. First, I just want to say that, of course, we all want the same outcome. We want youth and adults receiving necessary medical care and moving to the next setting with the right level of supports and services as quickly and efficiently as possible. However, counties do have concerns about the effectiveness of several sections in House File 671 on Min Choices Assessments, Sections 10 through 14. NACSA and counties have been and will continue to be in conversations with the author of House File 2372, Representative Nadeau, about concerns of provisions of that bill that are also mirrored here in the sections 1014 of this bill. Those discussions have included DHS, Children's Hospital, and MHealth Fairview, and advocates have agreed to remove the section related to fiscal penalties to counties, and we are committed to continuing this work on this bill with the authors and advocates involved. I can certainly attest, working within a county system, that counties and lead agencies would already be meeting the timelines laid out in this legislation if we had the capacity. Unfortunately, our current system and program expectations make that unattainable. County assessors balance the converging of multiple systems and layers in planning. This includes coordinating timing of medical assistance, application processing, state disability determinations, developing community provider capacity, and completing Min Choices assessments to ultimately get the supports a person may need in place for successful discharge planning. It is a fragile balance right now since every part of the system that people with disabilities depend on is experiencing delays and workforce challenges. While Min Choices assessment itself is important, it is only one part of a larger progression of steps, and addressing this piece alone will not resolve our larger problem. Measures such as financial penalties don't achieve the shared outcome and merely places the burden of an already stressed system onto local taxpayers and will not resolve the larger issue. We do agree that data is important and is an important element to inform our current and future solutions, and we continue to have discussions to refine these portions of the bill. We are not opposed to the concept of additional contracted or DHS assessors, but with the workforce that is currently churning within direct care, counties, DHS, and healthcare, we believe a more sustainable long-term solution would be simplification of our existing processes. This is why counties continue to work with stakeholders and bring forth bills such as House File 2406, which I believe will be heard later today. We look forward to continuing discussions with legislators and hospitals to collaborate on ways to solve these systematic complexities. Counties want to be part of the solution and completely agree that children and adults boarding in hospitals is not acceptable and is not reaching our end goal. I echo what Mr. Archibald stated, that collaboration is needed, and I am excited to be part of that process. Thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We now go to members' discussion. Representative Noor,
may I say something?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I do just want to say something. I hear all the time from lots of folks about how complicated the system is, and that's true. But I also hear that there's other cogs in the wheel, and that's also true. But statute actually allows for an expedited SMRT and an expedited MA in situations literally specifically where someone's only reason for leaving the hospital is lack of that determination. So those things can be expedited at DHS. They are frequently expedited at DHS. But if they are expedited and the Min Choices still doesn't happen, the children still don't leave.
Weapons of gun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's funny that played right into my question, because as I look at this, the thing that troubles me most about it is the complexity of it, right? The revisions that are being proposed themselves are very complex. I like the objective that we're generally trying to move toward. Is there a less complex way a more surgical way to move toward that objective? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
I love that question. So there's a couple of pieces about the complexity of this bill, but also the complexity of the system that we can absolutely get into the details. But the truth of the matter is that these children are complex. In fact, DHS's reports that have shared with us who's getting stuck in boarding, almost exclusively, they are children who are either involved in child welfare or adopted out of child welfare. Many of them are autistic and have that dual diagnosis component, and almost all of them have aggressive tendencies. That's almost exclusively who this is. So when we look at those three things together, the complexity of the human is why we have the complexity of the system. It is horrific to me, and I'm just going to say this like hard part out loud, is that most of these kids who are stuck boarding are our children. They are children that we put into child welfare. We removed their biological family's parental rights. We adopted them to new parents who are caring for them. And then when the complexities of the trauma and the diagnoses that we knew about impact that child's well-being and that family takes that child to the emergency room, we go, well, somebody will get to you. We'll get to it. The children are complex. The system is complex. The solutions must be complex.
Representative Gunn. With that, I think we have your closing remarks.
Thank you so much. I don't have anything else to say except for, I'll come back to what I said in the beginning, we can choose to do nothing. That is absolutely a choice, and I would encourage us to not make it.
Representative Hicks, we use the motion that House File 671 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Now I will turn over to Chair Keeler.
No, unless you... I mean, yes.
I think
okay, Chair Noor, are you ready?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Chair Noor, please move your bill.
I move House File 2331 be laid over for possible inclusion.
And I understand have you have an amendment, right?
Yes, I do have a DE1 amendment.
Okay, we'll move to adopt the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed say nay. The DE1 is amended. Chair Noor, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to go quick because I think we'll extend our time by a few minutes today just to get over some of the bills that we have. This bill, Madam Chair, members, as amended, it addresses a change to what we adopted last session, whereby we limited the DWRS services, particularly for customized living, to provide payment of up to 66% of the rates that they're receiving for the direct care services. Now we are trying to delay that whole process, and I will let my testifiers testify on the bill, and then we'll proceed with discussion.
Sounds great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Sondergaard. I'm the executive director of the Lodges, which has customized living settings around the metro area. I'm also a member of the Residential Providers Association Board of Directors. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2331 as amended, which seeks to delay the implementation of direct support staff obligations for the DWRS until 2029 and allow additional time for data collection and collaborative conversation with stakeholders. The bill would also clarify that the requirements should not apply to assisted living providers licensed and reimbursed under different statutes. As a provider of customized living, I understand the intent behind the original legislation. However, the current framework disproportionately impacts small providers like myself and fellow RPAMN members, particularly those who are unable to access other public programs intended to support residential settings like ours. Without private pay residents, we have no way of shifting costs to meet those obligations. Additionally, when we believe that the current statute is based on provider cost reporting system that many small providers have struggled to understand. Because so many providers, large and small, have struggled to navigate the cost reporting requirements, we believe the 2023 legislation may have relied on inconsistent and potentially inaccurate data. Further, we believe that in applying the DWRS requirement to customized living, we have failed to account for the unique licensing and operational costs of assisted living settings. Unlike traditional home and community-based services, providers licensed under 245D Customized living providers operate under a different regulatory structure, Chapter 144G, with significant additional costs, including assisted living directors, certified food protection managers, building and safety compliance costs unique to customized living settings. These costs are essential for compliance, service delivery, and quality of care, but are not considered in this the direct care compensation under the current methodology. Additionally, we have reimbursement, or we are reimbursed under a totally different statute. As a result, assisted living providers face a financial burden that could lead to closures or service reductions, reducing access to care for Minnesotans with disabilities and our aging population. As I mentioned before, many small providers do not have access to other resources for these kinds of settings, and we've been working with Representative Neuer and others to address that as well. However, until that work is completed, small providers will struggle to cover overhead costs, and their dollars will be stretched further. I urge this committee to support House File 2331. We must take the time to get this right to avoid unintended consequences that could harm the very individuals these policies aim to protect. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Mr. Benz, go ahead.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Ken Benz, and I'm the Director of Research, Analysis, and Policy for ARM. I'm here to speak on behalf in support of House File 2331 as amended. We understand that the Department of Human Services has the responsibility to gather and analyze data to maintain the various component values in the disability waiver rate system at appropriate levels and to ensure that service providers are applying their revenue appropriately, especially as it applies to the compensation of direct care workers. We also know that the sector has been chronically underfunded for many years, and that's why we come back every year seeking additional investment to support the direct care staff. So what's at issue here in House File 2331 are the compensation thresholds that were passed in the 2023 legislative session. We understand that the thresholds were determined through a high-level analysis of aggregate DWRS claims data from rate frameworks, which then yielded percentages of service rates that apply to direct care worker compensation. However, our concern is that providers will not be evaluated using that same methodology, but rather will be evaluated using cost reporting data for which the efficacy has not yet been proven. So through this bill as amended, we are seeking to delay the implementation of the compensation thresholds to allow DHS time to refine the cost reporting tool and to determine reasonable thresholds based on thorough analysis of validated data using the same methodology that providers will be evaluated against. We also seek to require DHS to engage with stakeholders and involve you as legislators in the development processes, in the development of process to ensure that the reporting process and thresholds are accurate. Thank you for hearing this bill, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. We don't have any other testifiers listed, seeing if there's any members of the public that wish to testify. Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Seeing no member discussion, we'll move to Chair Noor for closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have further closing remarks. I just wanted to move that House File 2331, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion.
Oh, I thought he said it just fine. Okay, so House File 2331, as amended, is laid over. All right, Chair Noor, moving to your next bill. Would you like to move your bill in front of the committee?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 2722 be laid out for possible inclusion, and I do have an amendment.
Okay, do you want to describe your amendment?
I'd like to move A1 amendment.
All those in favor, any discussion to the A1 amendment?
The A1 amendment makes some technical changes. I'd like to put the bill in the shape I want, so I will include that remarks in the presentation.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, say aye. Oh, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. We've adopted the A1 amendment. The bill should be in the form that you like. Proceed, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill addresses the positive support specialist and positive support analyst qualifications to include people who have completed competency-based program created by DHS. It also appropriates $1 million to the agency and I'll let my testifiers proceed with the testimony.
Go ahead, testifiers. Please say your name and organization for the record before you start.
Donna Cobb, Affinity Care Inman, and thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I serve as the Independent Service Director of Affinity Care, and I oversee the implementation of positive supports under 245D. I'm testifying in strong support of House File 2722. Positive supports, formerly known as behavioral supports, are individualized, person-centered services designed to proactively address challenging behaviors for adults and children. This service is essential. We support individuals across various settings, whether they're living in their own homes, licensed residential facilities, or navigating homelessness. The goal is to reduce behaviors that interfere with stability and community integration using evidence-based strategies that are proactive and not punitive. Despite the importance of positive support services, significant barriers prevent access. The U of M's 2022 statewide research and acute care transition advisory council report and recommendations of 2024 reports confirm families across both metro and rural say they cannot find anyone to provide their services, and in some communities, they don't even know the services exist. Individuals with complex needs are getting stuck in hospitals due to the lack of trained community support professionals, and only about 25 organizations statewide currently provide positive supports due to staffing challenges regarding rigid qualifications. Also, the need for competency-based training to address these staffing challenges. House File 2722 proposes targeted research-based solutions to address these issues. Number one, it removes outdated and restrictive experience requirements for professionals and analysts returning to pre-2019 standards. The current two-year requirement is a bottleneck and not reflective of what research shows is necessary for the success in the role. Number two, it introduces competency-based training pathway for positive support professionals aligning with best practices seen in other states like Virginia and Missouri, where competency models have expanded access and maintained quality. And three, it includes an appropriation to establish statewide positive support competency program. This investment would fund the development of free accessible training modules, tools for tracking and valuing staff competencies, regional mentorship systems, and a community-led competency-based review team. This goal is to build a sustainable, inclusive training infrastructure that increases both the number and diversity of qualified positive support staff across Minnesota, particularly in underserved communities. These are not just administrative tweaks. These changes can make life-changing services more accessible and equitable, particularly in greater Minnesota and other underserved communities that have historically had less access to specialized behavioral supports. And we've made progress. Last year, I testified in support of updating the qualification requirements for positive support staff, and I'm proud to say this change was partially adopted. Reducing the required experience for analysts from 4 to 2, and additionally, the most recent CSM waivers amendment now allows positive support services to be delivered in hospitals, which is a critical step towards addressing the acute care transition crisis in our state. This is a major win for individuals in crisis who need timely transitional specialized support for hospital stays to community integration support. Positive supports are a critical part of Minnesota's response to the mental health crisis and ongoing workforce shortage and disability services. Let's ensure these supports are available to the people who need them, when and where they need them. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm happy to remain available for any questions.
Thank you. Moving to the next testifier, we do need to kind of get through, so I'm not going to try to cut you off. If you could just make sure we're concise with our testimony comments, please. Go ahead for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I will try to make this short and succinct. My name is Heather Wilford. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst, and I currently serve as the organizational positive support strategist at Mainzel Services. We're a home and community-based service provider throughout Minnesota, and I'm here today to offer my support for House File 2722. I work with a wide range of people, from young children and their families to older residents living in community residential settings, previously referred to as group homes. My work has included supporting individuals dealing with grief-related aggression, suicidal ideation, and severe self-injurious behaviors that have led to hospitalization, the exact issues that we've all been talking about today. These examples highlight the critical need for mental and behavioral health services and underscore the importance of positive support services specifically. Despite a growing demand for these services, we face significant challenges in delivering them. One of the major barriers is the difficulty in training and retaining competent staff. The current standards, which place a heavy emphasis on years of experience and formal education, create obstacles to expanding these vital services for our communities. This is very particular in the rural areas where we see this most. Moreover, with the shortage of qualified providers, we continue to see a harmful cycle. Individuals are hospitalized, then they're discharged only to return to the hospital if adequate home and community-based supports aren't available. Hospitals, while critical for stabilization, are not equipped to provide long-term skill building or effective ongoing support in a person's natural environment. This cycle is not only detrimental to the individuals in need of these services, but it is also a significant burden on the state and taxpayers. By prioritizing competency in our workforce, we can create a more inclusive and effective system, offering meaningful training and ensuring professionals meet high standards and focused outcomes. This approach will help address workforce shortages, improve retention, and provide clear pathways for career growth, ultimately leading to better outcomes for the people that we serve. Additionally, this model will establish a consistent framework for training and service delivery across the state. In conclusion, the people of our state deserve effective treatment from competent professionals, and the changes proposed in House File 2722 can help make that a reality. Thank you again for your time and consideration.
Thank you. We have one more testifier listed. Are they in the room? Please move to the front. Please state your name and organization. And again, we only have 4 minutes left so to get through the bill, so make sure you can be concise, and then we'll move to closing remarks. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jessica Simisak, and I'm the director of the Teleoutreach Center at the Institute on Community Integration and the College of Education and Human Development and the Masonic Institute for the Developing Brain at the University of Minnesota. A lot of my work is focused on research and training aimed at improving access to developmental and behavioral health services for children and adults in Minnesota. I also served as a member of the recent Acute Care Transitions Advisory Council, which focused on information gathering and development of recommendations to improve transitions from acute care facilities such as hospitals for people who are stuck in those settings. I want to thank Representative Knorr for his leadership on this issue, and I'd like to share some comments in support of House File 2722, Positive Support Services. This bill would address, you know, critical current importance around shortages of provider capacity around Minnesota to support behavioral health needs for children and adults, particularly in greater Minnesota, where it's harder to access those services. There's two areas where I'd like to offer some very brief comments. The first is that need for provider capacity building. So there's community-level care outside of acute care systems to support those transitions back out of acute care and to hopefully prevent going into acute care in the first place, and the need for competency-based systems to improve provider uptake and adoption of positive support services to also ensure high-quality delivery of these services. We know there's an increased prevalence of need. Approximately 9% of school-aged children have developmental behavioral health needs that significantly interfere with their functioning at home or at school. In 2021, there was a joint state of emergency declared in child and adolescent mental health from the American Academy of Pediatrics, Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and of the Children's Hospital Association. And this has also resulted in this increased hospitalization and presenting at emergency departments for children who might have behavioral needs.
I'm going to have to ask you to finish up, please.
Okay, sure, absolutely. So we would the House File 2722 proposes changing these qualifications for competency-based pathways that would improve access to these services in alignment with also what was found in the Acute Care Transitions Council. Let's see, and thank you for allowing my testimony.
Thanks. I will move quick to member discussion, knowing we only have a couple minutes. Any member discussion? Seeing none, we'll move to Chair Knorr for your final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move that House File 2722 as amended be laid over.
House File 2722 as amended is laid over. We'll be coming back tomorrow morning, 8:15. Chair Schumacher doesn't really have any great updates other than we'll all get to be here tomorrow morning.
And Madam Chair, we'll come back to the two bills that are on the agenda at another time. So I just wanted to note that.
Yep. With that, we are adjourned.